are rolling with Studio 2 on a Wednesday. Welcome. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, yesterday was Super Tuesday.
It was?
It totally was.
Oh my gosh, thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, and I went to sleep and I was seeing all the things being tallied and got up this morning and it looks like we'll have a 2020 rematch come November.
Shocked.
Yeah.
I'm stunned. You can tell by my voice how shocked I am.
Yeah. And so today, that'll be part of our newsmaker segment. We're going to talk with Stephen Medvick, director of the Center for Politics and Policy at Franklin and Marshall College, about what Super Tuesday means for Pennsylvania, what it tells us about what's going to happen here for our primary and what to look forward to in 2024 for the general in November. We'll see. Also, we're going to be talking about the rise in betting, that is gambling.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. Just, I mean, you think about it, Avi, just a few years ago, there was no casino, like, you know, we didn't have sports betting. And now gambling is basically everywhere.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk about, you know, these virtual gambling devices that are now popping up in Philadelphia corner stores. We have Ryan Briggs, he is on the investigations team at the Philadelphia Inquirer, is going to talk about that part of it. And then we're going to talk about the broader issue of gambling and the rise of it, why so many lawmakers and legislative entities across the country have sort of leaned in. Yeah. We have Josh Aircole from the Council on Compulsive Gambling of Pennsylvania and Holly Sawyer, director of the Masters in Addiction Counseling at Drexel. We'll also hear from somebody who has dealt with a gambling addiction.
Yeah. Dave Yeager is a recovering problem gambler and has become an advocate. I'm really interested to hear what he says. And I'm also really interested to hear what our listeners think about this topic.
Absolutely. Email us.
Email us. Do you gamble?
Mm-hmm.
Do you enjoy it?
Do you know someone who's addicted? Did you hit big at one point?
Did you hit big? My dad just placed his first sports bet ever.
Wow.
On the college football playoff. I don't think he won.
Oh, I'm sorry, Big Wolf.
It's okay. He's fine. But it just made me think about the fact that it's like touching everybody in society. We're all kind of dipping our toes into this right now.
And it's becoming more normalized.
So, for sure.
Yeah. Email us your comments.
For better and worse.
Yeah. Studio2@whyy.org. That's the email. You can also call us. Get those in 888-477-9499. Now we're going to talk about some news headlines. Mm-hmm. Avi, you're up first.
You mentioned Super Tuesday. One of the sub-headlines for Super Tuesday was this uncommitted, non-committed vote within the Democratic primaries. And folks probably have heard about this, but many in the Democratic Party, a minority, but a notable minority, have been voting uncommitted in certain states to protest President Biden's support of Israel's actions in Gaza. And the question, of course, is whether this could pop up in our local primaries, which are still to come. The Inky had an interesting breakdown about this. It could be tougher for an uncommitted movement to really take hold in Pennsylvania because we do not have the option of just voting uncommitted, or there are other similar types of designations in other states. You would have to write in uncommitted in Pennsylvania, which is an extra step and also means that people have to kind of know what they're doing before they go into the booth. They can't just see it and
check
click
the box.
It.
Yeah.
So it might not be as prominent here in Pennsylvania. Also, I think the way like write-in votes get tabulated and reported, it's not quite as instant as like voting for an option. So it might just not have the resonance that even if a lot of people do write in uncommitted. But I thought it was an interesting story, and it gives you a sense of how this movement is really dependent on kind of arcane ballot design rules in different states.
Yeah, very interesting, because Michigan, I think, had the biggest turnout on the uncommitted voters with 100,000 people voting uncommitted in that primary, which was like 13% of the vote there. So that was quite interesting.
I think Minnesota topped that last night.
Minnesota topped. I didn't see the So a lot of people feel really strongly and want to send that message. I think the effort in here in Pennsylvania is run by the Democratic Socialists of America, and their push is called Vote Uncommitted PA. So we'll see if people in Pennsylvania next month.
I think the state to watch is actually New Jersey in our region. We're not really talking about it yet because that's a very, very late primary. Two reasons. One, New Jersey is a state. I just went through their rules this morning. There will, I believe, be an uncommitted column on the Democratic primary ballot in New Jersey. So that's one reason why New Jersey is a state to watch. Also, according to the latest Pew data, I believe New Jersey has the highest percentage, not raw number, but percentage of Muslim American citizens. And obviously, this is an issue of particular salience to the Muslim community. I think if this movement really continues to take root
in our region,
New Jersey is going to be the one to watch. Speaking of New Jersey.
Yeah. Embattled New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez is facing new federal charges, including obstruction of justice. Federal prosecutors say he allegedly gave false and misleading statements through his attorney to conceal the fact that a car that was given to his wife was, in fact, a bribe. Avi, the new accusations, they center on a $60,000 Mercedes convertible that prosecutors say was a payoff from a New Jersey Democrat whose name is Jose Uribe, a co-defendant in the case, who now admits to arranging to pay for that Mercedes, right? Originally, Uribe said the car payment was a loan that was to be repaid. He since admitted to lying about that and says the car was a bribe to Menendez, who in exchange agreed to use his influence to kill an insurance fraud case brought by the New Jersey AG's office involving Uribe. So this is another wrinkle in the case. Of course, I got to say that Menendez has come out strong against these latest allegations. He says the latest charge reveals, quote, far more about the government than it says about me. He says it says that the prosecutors are afraid of the facts, scared to subject their charges to the fair-minded scrutiny of a jury, and unconstrained by any sense of justice or fair play. Now, Uribe is going to testify if and when Menendez goes to trial.
Stay tuned, I guess. Very, very hard to make sense of all of the twists and turns in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Truly a globe-spanning case.
Yeah.
Doesn't look great.
Yeah, and I mean, this is, you know, I mean, well over a dozen charges against him.
Am I editorializing there by saying it doesn't look great for Bob Menendez?
It's just a lot. It's a pile on. Okay. It's a pile. Innocent until proven guilty, but this is his second indictment.
You're right. His
second indictment, and in just a few years, and it involves gold bars, cash, a lot of stuff involved here. So, and the Egyptian government.
Allegedly, Cherry.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's end our news headline segment with two stories about preservation that touch our region. The first is about the home that John Coltrane, the legendary jazz musician, once lived in here in Philadelphia. Oh, there's a little Coltrane coming up behind us there.
Naima.
Oh, it's Naima. Nice. I believe he actually wrote this song while he lived at this house in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia. The news is that there's going to be some money from the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund, this new initiative that they have set up to transfer properties to the descendants of the family. Right now, the family does not own the property, even though Coltrane lived in it for many years, and actually many of Coltrane's relatives lived in this same house over the years. It's now owned by someone else. This latest grant will, we believe, allow the property to be transferred back to the ownership of the Coltrane family, who hopes to turn it into some sort of public museum, memorial, something. Stay tuned.
Yeah, and his son Ravi was talking about this. He says that, you know, he wants it to be a symbol of what his father could do and what could be done. And, you know, Philadelphia has a rich jazz history, and John Coltrane is a part of that. We'll see if this
big
is,
part.
Yeah,
of that.
Big part of that. So looking forward to seeing this happen and have that house restored.
Would be awesome, because it has fallen into disrepair.
It has.
Second preservation story. I promised you two, Cherry.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch the very popular comedic program, The Office.
Mm-hmm. I've done that on occasion.
When the theme song starts up, you see this shot of a tower in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where the show takes place. Well, it's not actually filmed there, but, you know, fictionally it takes place in Scranton. You see this shot of a tower in Scranton that says pen paper. And it's sort of like an icon of the opening scene. Places you in Scranton. That's a real building in Scranton.
Oh.
And the folks that own it are trying to raise some money online to restore and maintain the tower, which is very, very, very old. And so they have appealed to fans of The Office. They have like an online fundraising thing going on, trying to get folks to give money so that they can. And by the way, it's a paper company that owns this building still. they're hoping that they can raise some money so that they can keep the pen paper tower standing upright, looking good, as a tribute to Michael Scott and Jim Halpern and Dwight Schrute and Angela and everybody at the office.
Interesting. I will say I looked at their online fundraiser. They've gotten about $4,200 of their $295,000 goal.
Whoa, that was the goal?
Yeah, their goal is almost $300,000, and they've only gotten $4,200. So from 16 donors. And I wonder if those folks are hardcore Office fans or not. But, you know, they do. A lot of people do love The Office and have that nostalgia. So people feel so inclined, they might do it. Who knows?
Let me put a question to you and the group. What is something in Philadelphia, like someone's home in Philadelphia, a great Philadelphian's home that you think should be preserved or like turned into some sort of like public space?
Interesting. That's
Email
a good question.
Us,
Let us know.
Studio2@whyy.org. Is there a great Philadelphian's home who you think should be, you know, preserved, maintained, turned into some sort of tribute?
I love that. And by the way, shout out to the folks at the Paul Robeson House, because they actually did transform his West Philadelphia house into like a community space and museum. So there you go. It is possible. So moving on to our newsmaker, Super Tuesday was a big win for former President Trump. He dominated, taking 14 of the 15 states which held primaries yesterday. His last remaining rival, Nikki Haley, announced the suspension of her campaign this morning.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well.
So we're back to a Trump-Biden rematch, something many political observers had been predicting for a long time. But both candidates face a lack of voter enthusiasm. And what about Haley's supporters? Where do they go? Here to help us sort through the Super Tuesday aftermath is Stephen Medvick, professor of government at Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania. Stephen, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much. I was hoping for some Coltrane back music there, but
we might have some other way out. We'll see. So, Stephen, got to ask you, I mean, Trump won mightily. What does his dominance tell us about the election nationally, but also here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's 2020 all over again. I mean, I think we saw this coming, at least close political observers saw it coming for a while. But I don't know that a lot of the average voters did. You know, people who aren't paying super close attention thought it was kind of hard to believe that it would be Biden and Trump again. But I think we saw the writing on the wall for a long time.
How would you compare Trump's position right now in Pennsylvania to where he was at this time 4 years ago?
I mean, you know, he was the incumbent 4 years ago, and he's not this time, but he's in about the same place he was. I mean, this is still, it's still a toss-up state. I mean, I think if you look at favorability ratings and all those things, not much has changed. People know a lot about him. Mm-hmm. They're not going to learn much more about him. And, you know, and it's a swing state, so it's going to be 50-50 pretty much, you know, all the way through the fall. So I think it's a lot of the same that we saw in 2020, and we can expect that, I think, for much of this year.
And that more of the same has led to this lack of enthusiasm. Are we seeing that in Pennsylvania, and what is that? How could that impact, you know, the outcome?
Yeah, we are seeing it in Pennsylvania. I mean, I think Pennsylvania is not unlike the rest of the country, and there's some dissatisfaction with both candidates. Actually, in this regard, in some ways, it's more like 2016, because back in 2020, Biden was seen pretty favorably. And so you didn't have as many of what we sometimes call the double haters, you know, people who see both candidates unfavorably. That was about 18% of the electorate in 2016, and it was down around 5 or 6% in 2020. Now we're back up to around 18-19% again this year. So those people are really unhappy, and in some ways that will – how they decide will determine the outcome. So in 2016, Trump won those voters. In 2020, even though there were fewer of them, Biden won those voters. And right now, they're sort of waffling back and forth. They're the most volatile voters because they don't like either candidate. And so back in the fall, they were supporting Trump. Now in recent polls, they've been supporting Biden by a pretty sizable margin. And so, you know, that gives Biden a bit of an advantage, but there are a lot of voters out there who are just not at all satisfied with their choices.
I am interested in these double haters.
Yeah.
Do they have issues that seem to rise to the top for them? Is there anything we can say about them other than they don't like these two candidates? Mm-hmm. And you can make it national, but if you have specific Pennsylvania insights, that's also wonderful.
Yeah, I don't think we know a lot about what's motivating them. I mean, they're probably not, and it's pretty clear they're not watching the election very closely. They're probably not very strong partisans, because if they were, they would favor one of their, they would favor their candidate more than the other. So they're the most probably disengaged mm-hmm. voters. I'm not sure that any particular issue drives most of them. Of course, there's different issues driving different voters in that category. But in general, I don't think we know a lot about them, except that they're just not happy about either candidate.
And so, Steve, I got to ask you, because Haley had supporters all over the country, definitely here in Pennsylvania. Where will those supporters go? Well, first of all, who are those people, and where will they go now that she's suspended her campaign?
Yeah, that's a great question. They tend to be more moderate Republicans. They tend to be better educated Republicans, and they just don't like Donald Trump. They may have voted for him in 2016 and even in 2020, but they're pretty dissatisfied with him as an option. Now, many of them will probably end up voting for him in the fall. Mm. I mean, this is, you know, the impact of partisanship is such that even if you don't like your party's nominee, you generally like the other party's nominee even worse. Mm. And so, you know, so you're likely to kind of come back home and vote for your party's candidate. But if you just can't do that, you may not vote at all. Or this year, you may look to some third party options. You know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is in the race. So in some states, he'll be an option for some of those voters. So, you know, I think what this is going to mean, and look, Biden's got some of the similar issues on his side as well. He's going to have to bring home some of his base voters. And so I think what this will end up being is can they generate turnout among their base of support?
And Stephen, before we go, can I just jam in this question about the uncommitted voter movement?
Yeah.
Will it peter out by November? Your thoughts, and can you do it in 10 seconds? So sorry.
Yeah, that's the key question. I think it probably will. The campaign will be effective in bringing people back home, but the Biden people have to take that very seriously.
Stephen Medvick, thank you for joining us on Studio 2. You asked for some Coltrane. We're giving it to you right now as a token of our appreciation here at Studio 2. That's Stephen Medvick, professor of government at Franklin and Marshall College. Coming up, the massive expansion of gambling. Our panel of guests are standing by, and we're closing, like I said, with some more Coltrane. Stick with us on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome on back into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're going to talk more generally about gambling later in the hour, but we want to start local. Corner stores here in Philadelphia have suddenly been inundated with devices called skill machines. They have giant, colorful lights, big displays. You can often find a pretty big crowd glued to them, hoping to win big.
Considered online gambling devices, they remain unregulated by Harrisburg lawmakers, but there has been major pushback here in Philadelphia. Ryan Briggs, along with Max Marin, reported for the Philadelphia Inquirer about these corner store machines and the issues that the city council here has with them. And Ryan is with us today to talk about the issue. Welcome to Studio 2, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ryan, I look at these devices, and to my untrained eyes, I see a digital slot machine. Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like to me. What makes them actually different in terms of how they're regulated and how they're played?
So this is mostly stemming from a series of lawsuits and subsequent court decisions by companies that make these devices. And there were several companies that sued, saying, we make devices that are a little different from slot machines. You have to play a game, do some matching, there's a puzzle, things that, as you say, aren't very obvious sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But the court said that is enough of a difference to sort of create a new classification of gambling machine, slot-like machine, whatever you want to call it. They say skill games. They say it requires some skill to play these devices. I think, as you say, when you actually see them in person, it's not really obvious how they are that different, but that's sort of the issue.
They're different enough in the eyes of the law.
Right.
And so that makes them totally legal. And so they're popping up everywhere. Where are they popping up? And how much money do they actually make?
So our reporting tried to analyze, you know, where these stores were clustering in Philadelphia. And we used kind of a mixture of zoning information, city records, and found that a lot of them had clustered in neighborhoods that, you know, had high poverty rates, had existing problems with maybe drug activity or other criminal activity. Kensington, if you walk along Kensington Avenue now, which is a major center for the opioid trade in Philadelphia, you'll see tons of stores. I mean, dozens of stores that often have dozens more machines inside. Some of them, you know, it's hard to tell if they even sell other products or offer other services. So, you know, we were trying to kind of focus in on, you know, the nuisance aspect of it. And it seems like there's a lot of overlap there with neighborhoods that are already struggling with a lot of other problems.
Yeah, let's talk about the nuisance aspect. So folks on city council, local lawmakers have made the claim that these devices are magnets for crime. But of course, you could easily make the argument that they're just in areas that would have had a lot of crime anyways, and any device, whether it's a machine or a loaf of bread, would also be in close proximity to crime. So what's the argument? And, you know, is it a fair argument?
The argument by city council?
By city council, yeah.
The argument by city council is that if you look at crime data, there are clusters that are occurring around these stores. The Philly Police Department has been unusually vocal about the need to get rid of these machines, saying that they add this additional kind of, you know, factor to areas that are, as you say, already dealing with all of this, you know, other types of crime. The gambling can, you know, be an inciting incident for maybe a violent dispute, you know, or it can compound issues you know, that are going on in or around these stores, draw more people in, whatever it might be. There are crime statistics that seem to support some of that. The police would say we look at these stores and, you know, again, there's some blocks where you've got maybe like half a dozen or more of these stores just on one block that are sort of focusing on gambling. And they're going to say, you know, look at all the shootings, look at all the drug activity in and around these stores. Store owners would say, you know, look, crime's happening already. The police are not responsive. We're suffering. We're getting hit with more regulation or attempts to regulate these machines because of the city's failure to grapple with those larger public safety issues.
And so let's talk about the money. Like, who's making money with these machines being put in these communities?
So we found two models when we went and talked to store owners. It's possible to buy a kind of a generic machine, I assume through the internet, that's shipped to you. You keep 100% of the profits. Something that was
you being the store owner.
You being the store owner, yeah. Sorry. What we found was more common, though, is that there were game makers going around and showing up at these stores saying, hey, I'll install this machine for free. You give us half the profits, you keep the other half of the profits.
Door-to-door salesman, essentially.
Pretty much. And that's part of the reason why they spread so quickly. Because, you know, we talked to a lot of people who said it's like even in the last 6 months, you've seen 2-3 times as many of these machines.
So it's like free money, basically, for the store owners. All they have to do is have the machine there.
Exactly. It's like not that different than a corner store owner installing an ATM to get fees off of it or something like that. We saw people who cleared out, you know, a row of chips or something like that and put the machines in. And they said, you know, make a couple hundred bucks a week, but that kind of adds up, right?
But these are small margin businesses, so a couple $100 a week could be a big deal.
Yeah, the most interesting comment that I feel like we heard was from one store owner who said, you know, the city had denied him a tobacco sales permit. He's in an area where the majority of people coming into his store, they're asking for cigarettes, right? This was part of a public health initiative to get rid of cigarette sales. So he said, look, I can't sell cigarettes. I need the extra money. I'm putting these machines in.
Crack down on one, you know, vice, I'll use air quotes there, replace it with another, essentially.
Yeah. I don't want to say either policy is bad. Obviously, that's just
was the sequence of events for that store owner.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about Harrisburg because there's efforts to ban it here in Philadelphia. But in Harrisburg, they want to regulate it and make money. What's going on in Harrisburg?
So you've seen certain larger game manufacturers, a lot of the same companies that brought some of these initial legal challenges that led to the unregulated system we have now, heavily lobbying to try to create a regulated system. They're saying, look, we make these games. They're real skill games. They're different from slots. We want you to regulate us. We'll pay taxes. We'll get rid of these kind of imitators that are out there that are just selling slot machines. That's kind of like the dynamic right now. It's gotten in Harrisburg, it's gotten wrapped into a larger budget dispute where you have, you know, different factions in government saying we want to get rid of these things, or, you know, interested in the potential for tax revenue to come out of them.
And it does seem like there are some differing visions about how heavily they should be taxed.
Yes, absolutely.
Well,
right, the rate and all that. But what's happening in the meantime, while all of that plays out in Harrisburg, is there is, and I can't emphasize this enough, no regulation of the machines at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you go into one of these places and it just looks like a little casino, there's not really anything illegal going on there. There's no law.
So to review, in a sense, court decision opens up this market, and right now there's just no one monitoring the market.
Pretty much.
And now they're everywhere. Corner stores, and laundromats.
And as you mentioned, city council locally is exploring avenues to try to ban them with, you know, local regulation.
Interesting. That is Ryan Briggs, researcher on the investigations team at the Philadelphia Inquirer, talking about these skill machines, these virtual gambling devices that have popped up all over Philadelphia. Ryan, fascinating. And thank you for coming on Studio 2.
Thanks again.
So let's switch gears right now to the bigger picture. A couple months back, mobile sports betting became legal in Delaware. And you might have missed that story, Cherry, because you know what? It wasn't really a story.
Nope.
Something that was illegal in 49 of 50 states just 6 years ago is now so commonplace that we barely blink when another state gives another form of gambling the green light.
And speaking of green, Americans are losing a lot of it. Gambling revenue hit a record $66.5 billion in 2023. That's according to the American Gaming Association. The speed of this shift, it is stunning. Gambling went from the shadows to the mainstream in less than a generation. Why, how, and what is the societal cost of this gambling gold rush?
We're going to pose those questions to our experts. Josh Aircole is executive director of the Council on Compulsive Gambling of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Holly Sawyer is director of the Masters in Addiction Counseling Program at Drexel. Thank you for joining us, Holly.
Thank you for having me.
And your comments are already rolling in. Drop us a line. Do you gamble a lot, a little? Why do you gamble? What do you get out of it? Do you think gambling is unfairly demonized, or do you think gambling is going to have major ripple effects? Let us know. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org.
And so, Josh, we're going to start with you to kind of lay the foundation here. How did we get here? Because, you know, it seems like just 20 years or so ago, you know, we had lotteries and gambling was only legal in a couple of states-ish. And now we have casinos, sports betting, and you heard, I mean, we have these skills machines and laundromats, for goodness sake. Can you give us just a brief history of how gambling has gotten to this point in America?
Sure. Yeah, it's been quite compelling over the course of the past 40 or 50 years or so. We've really seen things expand dramatically. You know, going back to 1978, that marked New Jersey opening casinos. That was the second state with casinos.
That's the Atlantic City boom.
Yeah.
That's it, yeah. And that's where things really began. And from there, obviously, we had lottery in Pennsylvania already. We had horse racing. We had some other types of games that started to become available. It was really in 2004 when there was legislation passed in Pennsylvania to bring casinos to Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And soon thereafter, 2 years later, the first one opened. We now have 17 properties that are open and operating, with another one that's likely scheduled to open at some point in the next year or two. And in 2017, there was the massive bill that expanded beyond brick and mortar facilities. But now we have online gambling. We have online casino-style gambling, we have online fantasy contests, we have online lottery games, we have online sports betting as well. And that's something that, you know, not just here in Pennsylvania, but all across the country has just absolutely expanded at not only at a fast rate, but just nearly every state now has some form of gambling. I think we're up to 40 states with sports betting.
Wow,
40 states.
40 states.
And sports betting specifically, I wanted to ask about that. The floodgates did kind of open there because of a Supreme Court decision, right? Can you just explain a little bit what happened there.
Yeah. So for a long time, sports betting was widely not legal. Basically, Nevada was the only state where you could, more or less, was the only state. There were a few states that had some different types of loophole availability. But by and large, Nevada was the state. If you wanted to bet on sports, you would go there. This ruling in 2018, May of 2018, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. And very quickly thereafter, you think about it, we went in 2018, gambling, sports gambling became widely legal. That bill that ruling basically allowed states to determine whether or not they wanted gambling, sports gambling, to be allowed in their jurisdiction.
And a lot of states said yes. And that's what's interesting about this. I want to bring in an email from Susan who says, I find it disturbing that cigarettes and liquor commercials aren't seen as much anymore, but every other commercial on TV is for gambling. Why is that okay? I want to use Susan's email to ask you a question, Josh, which is, just because states can do this doesn't mean they will have the political will to do it. And yet they all seem to have found consensus on this issue. Why does it seem like politicians who can't agree on anything seem to be rallying around opening up the gambling floodgates?
I think there's probably a lot of reasons. One primarily is, like Ryan was talking about, as we regulate things, they can become taxed.
Yep.
There can be oversight. And you know, the taxation of gambling in Pennsylvania is nothing short of significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically right now, every dollar that's spent on a slot machine at a casino, 55 cents goes back to the state. So it's actually more beneficial for folks to for the state than it is for the casinos that are open and operating throughout the state. And you know, the taxation that we see here in Pennsylvania, in many cases, is much higher than what we would see in neighboring states or other states around the country. So I think that's probably one of the leading areas. But I think it also kind of comes into the same discussion that we're having with the skill machines, is if they're going to be here, then at least if we do regulate them and have taxes, you know, in addition to that, we can also have things like player protections, and we can have tools that are available. We can have resources and connection to help. And that's really the main idea here, is that if we're going to have these forms of gambling, and not only are we going to allow them, but we're actually going to regulate them, it's so important to have protective language in place so that we can prevent problems from starting. But if problems do start, we can connect people with help quickly and efficiently.
And before we zoom out to the other part of this discussion, I got to ask you, I mean, the traditional notions of gambling was that it was a vice. Like, and we're sort of in America shifting our ideas about vice. We thought gamblers are these people who could get exploited, right? And, you know, but now we're moving towards this regulation equals revenue. When did you kind of see our attitude shift where we're no longer seeing this as we need to protect the people? Instead, we're all about the money.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's an interesting question. It's really an interesting 20 years or so that we've been looking at this specifically. Because you're right, you know, for a long time, there was kind of the classified, and I'll use air quotes, the stereotypical gambler.
Yep.
And really that image has changed to become so widespread, because let's face it, there's so many different people from all walks of life who are participating. We see a tremendous increase in younger folks who are now participating because things are faster and fresher and online and much more accessible. You don't have to go to a casino to play a slot machine or play blackjack or poker. You can now do it right from the comfort of your own home, your office, on a bus, wherever you are, on your mobile device. And then obviously sports wagering, that's something that has been very, very attractive to the younger individual. And I think, you know, as we continue seeing more participation and availability and increase, I think that's where that attention is really driven.
So that's the setup. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Josh. Holly, thanks for being patient, because we're going to get to you in the next segment some of the consequences of this sudden explosion of gambling all across our society. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome on back to Studio 2, everybody. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are continuing our conversation about gambling and the dangers of gambling addiction. With us in studio are Josh Aircole, Executive Director of the Council on Compulsive Gambling of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Holly Sawyer, Director of Masters in Addictions Counseling at Drexel University.
And we want to bring in one more guest on the line. This is Dave Yeager, who joins us now remotely from New York City, where he is at the annual Conference on Problem Gambling. He's also a U.S. Army veteran and recovery coach. Dave, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I want to set up this next segment, folks, with an email from Michael, who says, "All you need to do is watch The Sopranos to find out how insidious gambling is for the average individual. It's designed to separate people who are conned into thinking that the odds favor them from their money and ruin their lives." Dr. Holly Sawyer, is that a fair appraisal? Is gambling that insidious? How frequent is problem gambling, and what are some of the things that lead to it?
Yes, it is that insidious. The thing about gambling is it goes underdetected, under the radar, because it's not something that you can see or smell, as if someone is under the influence of a substance or alcohol. So I can easily hide it if I have a gambling problem or disorder.
And so, Dr. Holly, give us some statistics. Like, who is being affected by this disorder? Like, who is getting, like, sort of wrapped up in gambling addiction?
To be honest, I can't pinpoint a particular, you know, demographic. What I'll say is this: since the pandemic, gambling has, as far as the disorder and problem, has increased dramatically, at least three times. Because again, as pointed out, these are things that you can do from your home. So when we were quarantined, I can go to my phone, I can go to my cell phone or the computer and just do these things from my home. And then it can turn out to a full-on addiction over a four-year span. Now, you know, people don't necessarily have to go to the casino. And it can be teenagers because, again, it's not really regulated. But if I'm under the age of 21, I know I can't go to the casino, mm-hmm. but I can do it online.
Comment here from Facebook. Native says, "COVID changed the game," agreeing with you. Yeah. "It gave rise to DraftKings, FanDuel, and yes. every other opportunity to gamble via your phone and app. What used to be behind closed doors is now out in front. Mm-hmm. What's happening biologically, chemically, in our brains when we gamble, Dr. Holly Sawyer? What is it about this thing, gambling, mm-hmm. that gives it the propensity to become problem?
Great question. Gambling, like any other disorder, whether it's a drug or alcohol use disorder, we all want a dopamine rush, right? So whether it's pulling that slot machine, whether it's seeing the sparkly lights from the machine, whether getting on our phone, waking up first thing in the morning and having, you know, seeing a deposit hit or having the money to go and spend to think that we're going to win, it gives us that dopamine. And that's what's happening in our brain. And so once that dopamine is on a rise, we're constantly chasing it from the first time that dopamine hit to now making sure that we get it again and again. Even if you're losing, it doesn't matter. You're after the dopamine that you've had the first time around.
And I want to bring into the conversation Dave Yeager, a U.S. Army veteran and recovery coach. He wrote a book called Fall In, A Veteran with a Gambling Problem. Dave, tell us a little bit about your story, because compulsive gambling became a problem in your life.
Yeah, thanks. I actually fell into my addiction while I was on active duty in the Army. Little known fact, overseas military bases, most of them have in place casino style slot machine rooms right there on the military installation. So I was in Korea right after 9/11, a lot of stress, a lot of tension. I had two kids under the age of five, got over there, got settled in, and immediately my first night there discovered one of these slot rooms. And I didn't think I had a problem because I'm, you know, being from Pennsylvania, I've been to Atlantic City, and when I was younger, didn't have an issue, but got in there, sat down. And it wasn't long before I hit and won money, which usually is the trigger for this addiction. And when I won the money, I can remember in that moment, all the stress, all the tension, all the hurt, all the pain, all the things I was going through in that moment went away. So I spent the entire year in Korea basically chasing that feeling, because there were slot rooms in every single base in Korea. So I just kept doing it, and what started off as a fun little way to get away became an obsession and a need to do it. It eventually lost me my career in the military. It lost me my first marriage. It led to four suicide attempts, and it was a good
6 years before I finally sought help and found someone who understood what I was going through. And that's one of the biggest things to point out is the thoughts that ran through my head is nobody could ever understand what I'm thinking right now because I was leading a dual life. Nobody ever knew I was gambling. Nobody knew I had this obsession to gamble. It's so easy to hide, you know. So that was kind of, yeah. I finally found help through the Department of Veterans Affairs, and it took a long journey, but it got me to where I am now.
I want to read this email from Angel who says, mm-hmm. I find these commercials that push addictions deplorable. I'm horribly disappointed in the Hollywood stars that have been pushing and starring in them as well. I feel they are preying on vulnerable people, and it's shameful. Back to you now, Dave Yeager. You mentioned after about 6 years you were able to seek help. What was the light bulb moment for you that prompted you to seek help? And then once you were getting help, getting treatment, what was the breakthrough within that treatment sequence?
Okay. Yeah, well, first of all, the light bulb was more of a pit for me. it was a Friday night. I was driving toward a casino, and as I'm driving towards the casino, I'm yelling at myself to turn around because by that point I knew I would spend every dime I had. Well, I kept driving towards the casino, got to the casino, went in there, played, won, of course, I won money, was there for what I thought was overnight, turned out to be 36 hours. What I thought was about 6 or 7 hours turned out to be 36 hours of gambling straight, no food, no nothing. So, and of course I lost everything. I was so desperate at that point and in shame and depressed that I took basically a bottle of antidepressants, realized that it was more of a cry for help than a suicide attempt. So I checked myself into a hospital. I was there overnight. I woke up groggy. My head was spinning, but I realized I had a paycheck in my mailbox. So I checked myself out against medical advice, cashed that paycheck, and was right back at the casino the next day. And within 3 hours, spent the entire paycheck. And at that point, I knew I needed to do something, that I could not live this way anymore. So that was my kind of, eye-opening moment that this just couldn't go on. As far as what sticks and what made it work, to be honest with you, I've learned there are three things I need to do to maintain my recovery. Number one, I need roadblocks. So I've self-excluded in Pennsylvania and elsewhere.
Can you explain what that means, self-excluded?
Sure. The state of Pennsylvania allows you to basically ban yourself from gambling. So in essence, if I walk into a casino, I'm more or less trespassing. And even if I make it in there and I play and I win, they're not going to pay me because I'm on that list. Mm-hmm. So that's part one. Part two is I don't handle money at all other than on a limited basis. When I'm traveling, I have a card I carry, but my wife oversees every penny that I spend. And it's a relief for me because I have no temptation to spend it on anything but what I'm spending it on in that day. Now, I'm a few years well into my recovery, so those urges don't really come up anymore, but why tempt the urge? So that's roadblocks. Accountability is I make myself accountability to what I'm feeling, to my urges. I make myself accountable to my family. But then the third, and what I think is the most important thing, is connection. I stay connected through a 12-step group that I'm involved with Gamblers Anonymous. I stay connected by being a recovery coach and working with other gamblers. And by doing those three things, I keep myself from moving towards any urge that might come up. Do I still get urges? Yeah, occasionally. But I recognize them, and I'm able to let them pass very quickly versus allowing myself to, if you will, you know, go down the rabbit hole.
Mm.
And I want to bring in this email from Deb, who says, the very first time I went to the racetrack, I won $5,000. I was young and I had a gambling partner and we thought we may be able to beat the system. And sort of, you know, Deb says sooner or later, we bought a book on how to beat the odds. And sooner or later, the tables turned. We had got a hot tip on a horse guaranteed the win, but the end of the story, that horse was dead last. It was the end of my gambling career. Dr. Holly, just sort of people get caught up, and you know, we heard from Josh, you know, the sentiment has changed from, you know, we're trying to protect people to we're trying to make revenue, right? Are politicians open to hearing the argument that more and more people are falling prey to addiction when it comes to gambling?
I hope that they are, because this issue is not going anywhere. And I think with now with these so-called skill games and putting them in laundromats and corner stores, it's only going to get worse, right? There's no regulation there. So people are just going to be able to go grab, you know, a gallon of milk and, hey, let me sit here and make some money off these machines and then just abandon other parts of their lives because, you know, hey, I'm here at this machine, like he mentioned, 36 hours. Yeah. Or at least until the store closes, I'm there. Mm. And then where do I go from there? Do I go to my phone? Do I now go grab scratch-offs? It doesn't stop. It starts a very, very large slippery slope.
And my follow-up to you, Dr. Holly, if you're, how do you even see, if you're living with somebody, what are some of the clues that someone may have a gambling addiction?
Great question, Cherry. So I have a couple questions that you can ask yourself or a loved one, because again, gambling can go so under the radar. You may not, again, see pupils dilated. You may not smell it like you can with alcohol, but you can ask yourself or a loved one, do you or the person think about gambling a great deal of your time? Do you lie about your gambling to others? Do you gamble while your bills go unpaid? Do you borrow money to finance your gambling? Do you miss work because of your gambling? And do you feel anxious, depressed, or suicidal after you gamble but not quitting? Right. So these questions are not all exhaustive, but these are some questions you can ask, because gambling is such a financial, sign or burden that you wouldn't necessarily see or smell with a drug or alcohol disorder.
I want to bring in a different perspective now from Fiona, who writes an email who says, as an Australian, we grew up with gambling as a normal part of life. It was not stigmatized as it was in the USA. But because it was not stigmatized, I think people tended to keep it in balance. I think we should point out that the statistics seem to suggest that most people who gamble do not develop a gambling disorder like this. And I think there's an argument, right, Josh, that when you prohibit something, you can push people into the shadows. That's what prohibition did with alcohol. And that there's an argument that this should be a legal but regulated space. Walk us through that argument, pros and cons.
Sure. I think that's a really important point. You know, at no point do I want to misconstrue our message is not that gambling is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's an activity. It's something that's enjoyed by millions and millions of people around the world and around the country and here in Pennsylvania. And you're right, the vast majority do not develop problems. You know, research, 97-98% of the population does not significantly have a major problem. There's, you know, a lot of different research has been done, obviously, and the numbers kind of vary. But by and large, as far as these extreme problems, we're looking at maybe 1% of the population. Now, that equates to a lot of people, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
millions
of
people.
Because more people,
because the number of people going.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, as we continue to see, you know, like it was pointed out, we've seen an increase, at least in the people who are reaching out for help over the last few years. And that likely translates to an increase in problems.
So what guardrails do we need as we wrap up this conversation?
Sure.
If it's going to be legal but regulated, what types of guardrails do we need to make sure that those folks in the 1-3% don't develop these life-altering problems?
I think having, right from the get-go, I think having early education and prevention programs established across the state, across the country, I think that's vital. Building, you know, helping folks to understand more about the risks that are associated with this activity. And the fact that, you know, just because you participate doesn't mean that you're going to develop this disorder, but you have to know how to handle it properly. And if you're not able to stick with the rules that you set for yourselves or the limits that you're setting for yourselves, then maybe this isn't an activity that you should be participating in. You know, and I think building that resiliency, because let's face it, we're not hiding from this. We're not escaping it. This is something that's here, and it's not going anywhere.
And I want to throw a comment here. Matt comments on Facebook, my only gambling is the occasional $20 game of Texas Hold'em. Thank goodness I've never been tempted by serious gambling. So some people can really enjoy it. And thank you to Victor, Renee, and Douglas for your comments as well. We're sorry we couldn't get to them.
So let's wrap up the segment now. Josh Ercole, Executive Director of the Council on Compulsive Gambling of Pennsylvania, thank you for your time. Dr. Holly Sawyer, Director of the Masters in Addictions Counseling Program at Drexel, thank you for your time. And Dave Yeager, U.S. Army veteran, recovery coach, and author. Dave, thanks for your time from New York City. And we also want to mention the National Problem Gambling Helpline. The number is 1-800-GAMBLER.
Again, 1-800-GAMBLER. That wraps our show. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Besser, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks, folks.